Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, January 25, 2014. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. And our topic for today, the short version, is Save Lives, Save Civilization. And I want to welcome, we have two guests for certain. I'm glad to have with us by telephone, and a third one may join us. The two are from Pennsylvania and the New York, New Jersey metropolitan area, and the third from California. But I'm going to, when I say save lives, save civilization, let me say right in advance, we're having medical specialists on, two physicians and a nurse, because along with their credentials, they are outstanding for their commitment that we are in a fight to the death with the enemies of mankind that brought our nation and our people and people around the world to the pass where we have a completely declining economy, except for, fortunately, certain precious singular initiatives, in particular from Eurasia, on science and advancement. As you can see in the recent moonshot by China, that kind of shows we ought to be aiming at the heavens and lifting people up instead of saying the world is coming to an end, resources are used up, we have too many people. That's an enemy point of view. But our guests have been very much leading the charge to restore the principle of progress. And so the first person I'd like to welcome, and he's talking to us today from North Central Pennsylvania, is Dr. Mark Shelley. Welcome, Dr. Shelley.
Thank you.
And I'll just say a few things about him and then our other guests. But Dr. Shelley is, who can tell you more about his own practice, over 20 years, I think he's been a general practitioner there in rural North Central Pennsylvania. But over the last year, when the Schiller Institute sponsored six transatlantic conferences, that we need a new paradigm for mankind towards progress and away from this dangerous dead-end outlook that has even brought us to the brink of all-out war, we need a new paradigm. Dr. Shelley, about a year ago, went to New York City to participate at a conference there and spoke about the crisis in medicine, where both patients and staff, doctors, nurses, and staff have been dehumanized, I guess you could say, and medicine has been turned into a money commodity. And then in the fall, October, Dr. Shelley issued a call for others around the United States and abroad to join Doctors Against Murderous Obamacare. That's a quote. I'll give the email where you can contact that grouping, but it speaks for itself, and Dr. Shelley will say in a very few minutes why he did this, that we are in an emergency situation. But secondly, I want to invite to say hello to our friend in the New Jersey, New York City area, Dr. Ernest Shapiro. Hi, Ernie.
Hello.
And I've known Ernie for decades. He's licensed to practice in New York, his home state. He's retired now, but when I say decades, Ernie has collaborated to intervene in various ways over the years in general, but in particular, Ernie, you may say more about this. You've been an outspoken fighter against this whole concept that we should legalize dope. I say that because President Obama just a few days ago said, yes, marijuana is no danger, more dangerous than drugs, than, excuse me. And you also were on the front lines of trying to restore the Hill-Burton principle to healthcare in the country, which built up our hospital system after the Second World War. And you fought, I remember well, in 2001 when the nationally world famous hospital in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, called D.C. General Hospital, was said to be too costly and they shut it down. And you were leading the charge that we should never let that stand. So finally, in California, a person who may join us after the discussion already starts is a career nurse there, Judith Nergy. She's very active, and she participated in the June Schiller Institute New Paradigm Conference out in San Francisco in 2013. She's in the most populous state in the nation, has seen it all, and is part of the Nurses Association out there, the union and the association, very concerned about fundamentals of care, like the staff to patient ratios and that kind of thing. So I hope Judith can join us. She's working this weekend, that's why it's up in the air. So let me, before I turn to Dr. Shelley, let me just say a few things by way of update to introduce our topic in particular, because the reason we look forward to these medical expert guests is that at large we're in the end phase of crisis for our nation and the world economy, except for, as I said, certain very important counter initiatives to the collapse that are especially taking place among Russia, China, and Eurasia. But we have had a situation where these Wall Street, City of London, transatlantic-based financial interests that you might call, maybe you should call them the Neo-British East India Company. They're Anglo-Dutch. They've been operating through cartels and financial and dirty tricks to loot nations and economic activity to the collapse point. And their point of view is the old royalist kind of oligarch, we're on the top and you're on the bottom, and if you weren't born on the bottom, we'll impoverish you till you are. And we have these financial bailouts going in different forms to the few mega banks, the famous names in the transatlantic area, I mean, such as Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan Chase, this crowd, while at the same time the actual living conditions, food, nutrition, opportunity to work and to be human are being killed off by the hour. So that's the vantage point we want to proceed from. There is no appealing or rectifying the situation by limited appeals to fairness or something. We have to get rid of this crowd and these bums. People are suffering, they're more sick. In many of the counties of the United States, we have some 3,000 counties. Life expectancy in gross statistical terms is going down because people are poor, demoralized, don't have the means to exist. And and one of the big problems about all of this is the what's become the green prevalent outlook that, well, resources have peaked, people have to die off because they're overpopulated, or there's the fiscal argument. The budget has to be balanced, get rid of food stamps if you have too many poor people, too bad, so sad. If you have too many people out of work, cut their employment off. We have a horrendous economic but a moral collapse going on, because the reality is resources and technology and advancement have always been man-made. Dogs and cows and beasts can't do it, but human beings can figure the way out of this, develop higher levels of technology and the productive platform. And that's what our fight is about right now, especially setting our sights to the heavens to resume going nuclear, even looking for an early, maybe think of it in just a decade or so, of going for fusion power, not just nuclear fission. So that's all what I wanted to reiterate, because I have a couple of announcements. Namely, please watch in the next few days, it might be 24, 48 hours. Mr. Lyndon LaRouche is writing a new paper with an expanded perspective of what I just described. And the other thing I'd like you to watch for in the next few days, I think you'll see it on the Schiller Institute website. I just put in Schiller Institute and you'll get the right specific website, or LaRouchePAC.com. Look for the video and audio final edited version of last Sunday's concert in Boston, which was in commemoration of the 50th anniversary date, January 19, 1964, of the memorial to President Kennedy, who had been killed in fall 1963. And at that in Boston at the Cathedral of the Holy Cross in 1964, and then again last Sunday here in 2014, the Mozart's Requiem was performed and interspersed at certain points with quotes from President Kennedy about going to space, going to develop the land and water resources of our continent through water management and dam systems, going for nuclear power, desalination. It was ineffable. I won't go on about it. I could, because I was there. I got the opportunity to sing in the chorus and met many of the 1,200 people in attendance in that, it was full in that beautiful setting. And one I met had been there in 1964. And he said, "Don't get me started on what's happened since then." And we had an immediate communication of what he meant by that, whether it's art, music, science, or the art of healing, the art of compassion. And that brings me around to our guests now with their special pedigrees, is that what I'd like to start with is asking Dr. Shelley if he would open up the discussion as to why last October 2013, you issued your call, Doctors Against Murderous Obamacare. You had a press conference in your own office in Pennsylvania, and you had already spoken out at an international conference in New York about the fact that our health system and medical treatment system was in trouble. But finally, you went ahead and took this, what you could call a political step, because the situation was dire. Would you explain?
Well, as you say, I'm a physician by training, and I'm really not. I don't consider myself to be an activist or a politically savvy in any way a person. All I want to do now, my intent has been to make my patients well, and as 5 years and decades went by, I became less and less able to make my patients well, and it seemed like maybe it was a local problem, or it was a problem that was singular in some way. But it became more and more clear that this was a systemic problem with the practice of medicine, and then it became even more clear that it was not just with medicine, but with society at large. So if my intent, if my goal, my hope is to make my patients well, I can struggle with one patient at a time to make them well. Or if I can make even a small difference in the entire system, then I can help many, many more people that way. And so I started to try to connect it up, so to speak, to integrate what is the problem? What the problem that I was told again and again was that there was there's no money. The money's gone. Your patient can't stay in the hospital because there's not enough money. And your patient can't have test A or test B because there's no money. And at first this was relatively subtle, but then it became, it was shameless. Still, I mean, today in 2014, it's absolutely shameless that care will be denied for monetary reasons, and there's really not even much explanation or much. It's not even covered up. It's simply, oh, no, because we have your money, and we say no. So, it became obviously an economic problem, a matter of resources, as you alluded to earlier, that the resources are not available. And in the course of evaluating the problem that I'm faced with, how to make my patients well, I found the data which showed that we as a country spend, in 2012, I think it was, spend roughly 16-17% of our GDP on health care. The members of the OECD spend at least at least half that much and sometimes approaching three times less than we do, a third to a half as much of the GDP to treat patients with a higher quality, with better outcomes. So, okay, now the problem is, why are we working so hard and getting so little traction? Where does the money go? Why? How can we possibly be spending this much money on healthcare and getting such poor results? And why does such a system continue to survive? Why any business would have failed long ago, any truly competitive business? And then it became more and more clear that the system, the failure of the system is from deceit and manipulation. And with sort of a piece on the left and a piece on the right, it became more and more evident that this was absolutely systemic problem. That it's a problem of loss of principles. It's a problem of a loss of morals. And being human, I did what many people do, which is to project my values onto others. And I couldn't believe that we weren't following the Hippocratic Oath in the care of patients. People were unprincipled, because I always was principled, and it just seemed that everybody must be, other than maybe a stray person here or there. And as you look deeper and harder, you find that the principles have been brushed aside, that the principles are really not, they're no longer primary. Patients, we don't see patients, we don't get paid so that we can continue to see patients. We see patients so that we can be paid as much as possible. And that became, as years and decades went by, suddenly it became normal that we would, I say we, and I'm speaking of the medical profession, but second part of this problem, which is very complex, but the second part of the problem is that the profession is no longer the profession. The profession is now an instrument of a system. It doesn't have its own legs. It's not independent now. Where most of us are employed, many of us have financial difficulties that require us to continue to, go along to get along, so to speak, and not offend our employers or certainly the insurance companies, and we're tempted daily to, shouldn't say falsify, but embellish requests for tests so that if we know what the insurance company will allow a test to be granted, if an MRI requires so many weeks of conservative therapy before we're allowed to order this test, then the form gets filled out that it's been that many weeks. And so, point being, the profession has eroded, it's really eroded, in order to just keep putting one foot in front of the other. So of course, the fact that I can't, that I come to the hospital and find my patient dead is not an isolated problem, it's not a local problem, it's the entire system. And as you keep, it seems that you'll never get to the root of it, but as you go from the patient not having care because it was refused by an insurance company to the patient not having care because the hospital was closed because of a regulation, or the antibiotics not available because the drug company made the price so high through unethical manipulation that the insurance company refused to buy it through unethical manipulation, so that the patient didn't get what he wanted, And the time that I spent trying to figure out what I would do instead of that was time that I didn't get to spend for Mrs. Smith, who was to be seen after Mr. Jones, and Mrs. Smith went home and had an MI and died. So that's not local, because the reason these patients were refused care, the reason that their care was not available, was from a deeper problem, and it's the insurance industry or the bar association or the pharmaceutical industry, which is profoundly unethical, or the fact that so many physicians are afraid to speak up because they don't want to offend their employer. And so it becomes really, above all, a financial or an economic issue, and then a political issue, which is determining the politics, or determining the economics, and then a principal issue, an ethical issue, a moral issue, which is allowing the politics to be tainted. And so I thought, wow, this is big. This is bigger than I can really manage by myself. But maybe if I can find somebody who will listen to this story, it will help them to make sense. And little by little, if people can sort of understand that these dots are all connected, maybe they'll make better decisions, and we can plant some little trees that will become an orchard.
Well, let me put in here for people listening too. Look this fall at LaRouchePub.com, where your EIR news subscription, and Dr. Shelley, your speech is carried in fall 2013 about just the process you described. For example, the number of physicians you pointed out when you spoke in New York who are independent today, that is, they own at least a part of their practice. It used to be 50 years ago in the 1960s, maybe 85% of all the physicians in the country owned part of their practice. And now that's below 36% or so. Is that right?
Those, yeah. And as I remember, that 36% are physicians who own a portion of the practice, that have a certain degree of autonomy. So it's not that 36% of patients are autonomous. It's that 36% of physicians have some say in their employment. So
right, and so with the huge when young physicians come up, they have a lot of debt. There's tremendous pressure to work for one of the mega chains or to not be able to set up your own practice, right?
Yeah, that was, there was, I don't know, the numbers were striking, but it's in that November 8th, 2013 EIR.
Okay.
Those folks were the residents who saw employment as a first choice 10 years ago was 3 or 4%, and 10 years on, 2010, 2011, it was a third to a half. It was considered the best way to go to practice medicine.
In other words, to go higher on somewhere. Let me ask right now too, because there's much that was in your, this explains the steps you've been taking. And Dr. Shelley's call must have made sense to you when you heard about it this year, right?
Yes.
Do you want to say something?
Well, yeah, I would just add another dimension to what he laid out, and that is a certain, you mentioned the moral side of it, be specific, it's the attitude toward the sanctity of life. I think this is a fundamental question. You take this interview that President Obama did in the Sunday New York Times magazine, I think it was around the first week or so in May of 2009, and it was on the cost of health care. And he brought up the case of his grandmother, and she had cancer, and this and she fractured her hip. I think she fell and broke her hip. And question was that Obama brought this up in the context of what he said were unnecessary and unjustifiable medical costs which needed to be contained. What he said was that you needed a committee of sort of judges, you sort of, to decide whether the cost of her having a hip replacement or whatever surgery she needed was justified given her short life expectancy. And she was my grandmother, so I might have paid it out of pocket if it was necessary. But you know, but the point is that he was saying that it's not worth it. You have to. In other words, he's introducing. It's this thing that Leo Alexander talked about, you know, in connection with Alexander was the psychiatrist who was involved in questioning and the Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg, and also was involved in the trial directly. And what he said was that what was the issue was of introducing utility into medical care, the idea that the measure of whether you should treat somebody at all is just whether you can cure them. If you can't, if they're not rehabilitatable, their treatment is of secondary importance. And the idea being that they don't contribute anything to society. And it was this philosophy, it was this, as Alexander said, it's just, this thing had the Nazi, you know, euthanasia had a small beginning. But this idea of the idea that there were these lives that were not worthy to be lived because the person, say, was had Alzheimer's disease or they were, you know, deformed in some way.
Or maybe just old, right? All right, Dr. Shapiro, just old.
Yeah, of course, yeah, that's right. And this is, remember, that what's his name, Ezekiel Emanuel, who was a key person in formulating Obama's policies on health care. He came up with this idea of a longevity penalty. In other words, as you get older, you should get less Social Security because you're too old. Okay? And then the head of the American Bankers Association talked about a longevity tax, you know. So the idea is that you introduce this something over and above and in place of the sanctity of life as a criterion, then you inevitably, given the pressures that the doctor is talking about, you're going to end up exterminating people. In effect, that's what's going to happen. Okay, and that's what we're really seeing. It's this,
absolutely,
this philosophy of utilitarianism as opposed to the sanctity of life. And Alexander warned about this, but it didn't really, you know, this philosophy was under some restraint because if you had countervailing trends and policies up to a point, like the thing that you, Marsh, you've written a lot about, the Hill-Burton legislation.
Yeah, the 1946, so people know that was really, it was Senators Hill and Senators Burton, bipartisan, but it was called the Hospital Survey and Construction Act, and the motivating idea is build the infrastructure to have enough beds, staff, diagnostics that everyone should have modern care that's possible. Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Shapiro.
Yeah, and also there was a provision that the federal government would assist the locality in building a hospital to meet the needs of the community. But there was a proviso that this hospital must give a certain percentage of its care to those who could not pay for it. So the idea that everybody was entitled to health care as a basic right was behind this Hill-Burton legislation, which was also based on our wartime experience, you know, the experience of having to take care of so many people in the military. So I think this is
Yeah, you bring out these important points. And in fact, let me just say now, Dr. Shelley, you you, when I had a chance to visit you in your own practice offices there, you said that the proliferation of instances where it is considered that the patient involved is not worthy of care, like shouldn't have a colon test or I have to tell Dr. Shapiro and others, you said you can pick up any medical magazine at random and you're going to find at least one article where this is going to be brought out. And I saw you grab a magazine off the stack on your office floor. And sure enough, it was there that discussing at what cutoff point in people's lives who are in their 70th decade should they cease having colonoscopies. But expand on this now, how rampant it is.
Well, Dr. Shapiro made some, I appreciate what he said, because it's another way of trying to, it's another way of explaining what I'm trying to enunciate. And I think the more ways we can shine a light on this, the more people will understand the straits we're in. When he said, and we spoke about Dr. Leo Alexander, which I have to recommend that anybody listening would read that, his 1949, I believe, New England Journal article, Medical Science Under Dictatorship. But when he spoke of that, it's the dehumanization. It's considering people to be quantifiable somehow. They are exactly as valuable or spirited or complex as cattle or snails or trees. That when you can say that human beings can be measured and you will decide whether or not you will roll the dice depending on how big the purse is. I mean, you've crossed into an area where you absolutely cannot make the right decision. And to come back to the whole colonoscopy issue, that was interesting because I literally did pick that up randomly. And that study, as I recall, for that guideline, we have to all work by guidelines now.
Okay.
The guideline was that when a person is 70 years old, or if they do not have a life expectancy of more than 10 years, given their other diagnoses, that you should not order a colonoscopy because colon cancer takes 10 years to develop. Okay, this is evidence-based medicine, which is another. There was some wonderful articles about evidence-based medicine. I'll be brief with the digression. There's a woman, Dr. Helgeson. I'd have to recommend anybody look at her evidence-based medicine articles. But so the evidence-based medicine said that in the event that this person wasn't expected to live more than 10 years, they should not have a colonoscopy because it takes more than 10 years to get colon cancer. Problem with this logic is, A, death by colon cancer is ugly, okay? B, there are other problems that you might have besides colon cancer that would be diagnosed by the colonoscopy. When you have an analytical approach, a limited number of, when the question is very simple, the answer is very simple. Human life is not a simple thing. Diagnosing, treating, healing humans is not a simple thing. It's not done by pathways. It's not done by algorithms. And it's most certainly not done by people who have no training or accountability for the outcome of this. And when we look at when we ask ourselves, is that indeed how medicine is practiced in this country today, or maybe to some extent in Western civilization? I think the answer is yes, that medicine is driven, decisions are made, lives are lost because of the decisions of people who have no accountability, no awareness of this human being whose life is in the balance. The point being originally that Dr. Shapiro makes a very salient point in saying that these people were seen as commodities. Their humanity was ignored.
Right, and Dr. Shelley and Dr. Shapiro, this is a good point. It turns out Judith Nergy, who's the nurse I already introduced to you in principle, has joined us from California. Welcome, Judith.
Thank you, Marcia.
And I explained you have long experience there, are active, and we're at the Schiller Institute New Paradigm Conference, Judith. I don't know when you were able to hook in, but just this point that the gentlemen here are discussing must be very real to you about Dr. Shelley's call for Doctors Against Murderous Obamacare kind of put it on the table of the crisis we're in today. And this must have made sense from your perspective in day-to-day situation out there in populous California trying to fight for ratios of care and so forth. Do you want to say something about anything about that?
Well, I'm fortunate enough to work in the field of labor and delivery, so I get to attend women in labor and the birth of babies,
mm-hmm.
which is an amazing area to be in. And you know, the place that we're seeing some of these cuts manifest are in the staffing of the nurses in the hospitals that I happen to work for Kaiser Permanente, which is a very profitable HMO, and yet they are attempting to cut back on the nursing care and are advertising the fact that more and more people will be able to be cared for in their homes by themselves or by their families, which is ludicrous, to say the least.
It's certainly a national assertion as part of what the others that we've already spoken about on this program based on the premise of the kind of imperial premise saying, well, resources are limited. You can't have care institutional or high-skilled care. You can care for your own family in your own home, whether you can or not, is just a ruse. I'd like to throw in here to all three of you for 1 minute. I heard Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, who Dr. Shapiro mentioned, who was one of the authors of the 2010 Act yesterday in Washington, D.C. on C-SPAN video, when Ezekiel Emanuel was speaking of just the kind of thing you were, Judith, about all these innovations we can have that will, based on the premise we're going to cut costs. And in particular, he took credit for writing a section of the Accountable Care Act of Obamacare, and it's called PCORI, that's PCORI, and it's now got double the budget this year. And here's what this agency stands for: Patient Comparative Outcome Research Institute. And the agency is studying that really there are, when you compare outcomes of patients, there are too many, too expensive, and too varied kinds of treatments, procedures, tests going on, and we're going to force the issue and cut a lot of them down. So I'm just underscoring that this 2010 Act is, besides the crazy rollout of it where supposedly you're supposed to be able to sign up, you can't, 9 million people don't qualify anyway, they're too poor to be subsidized for getting an insurance policy or make too much for Medicaid. Besides all that, all of this is to cut people's lives. So I'm just throwing that in because Ezekiel Emanuel was here in Washington, and he hit the groups that held seminars yesterday about how we're going to have comparative studies in order to decide what to cut. They said, for example, there's too many hypertension drugs. Diuretics was a breakthrough in the 1960s, but there's too many kinds of treatments. The networks that are active are directly connected to the Anglo-Dutch imperial crowd that says the world is overpopulated. One of them is named Simon Stevens, and he did Tony Blair's program to undercut the National Health System of England, NHS, in 1999 to 2003. Simon Stevens works for United Healthcare now, and he's the biggest insurer in the United States, if not the world, and he's going back in April to head the National Health Service of England to do no good. And he's on a group here called the Commonwealth Fund, and they're proposing that costs must be slashed. We can't wait around. And I just threw that in there. Sorry to take the time, but any of you may want to expand on that about how severe this assertion that we don't have any resources. One thing, Dr. Shelley, your speech has laid out that something like 30% or more of all the healthcare dollars in the United States go to profits and overhead of the mega insurers, Ring of Wall Street. Is that right?
Oh, I would guess that it was even more than that. I think the 30% that, I mean, there was a question of how much is spent on administration costs.
Okay.
The 30%, yeah, the 30% was an administrative cost. And that's advertising, that's administrator secretaries, you know, administrator secretaries.
Very high wages for the highest administrators.
Sure. And, you know, is that really healthcare? I mean, we can't lose perspective. We are spending 2.5 times as much money. We're paying, we're paying gourmet prices for McDonald's. Mm-hmm. We're paying much, much more than fellow countries in the developed world for a much lower quality healthcare. I guess, and when Ezekiel Emanuel and Obama say, yes, well, we have to, you know, there aren't the resources, you have to say, that's my point. Why aren't there the resources? What did you do with the last money I gave you? You know, what you say to your kid, what did you do with the last cookie I gave you? And it's, you know, what did you do with that money? You wasted it. That's what you did. You wasted it, and now you're telling me that I have to let my patient die or that I can't do a colonoscopy on a patient who might have a very low level of colon cancer or might have colitis or whatever. You're telling me I can't do that because you wanted to spend it on your secretary, or maybe more to the point, on the stock market, the dividends from the insurance company. Or the million-plus dollars that goes to the administrator of one of these places.
Which brings us back, you know, once again, to the absolutely essential, that it's absolutely essential that we pass Glass-Steagall so that that our economy can come back to caring for people, rather than caring for Wall Street. And no matter what single issue we're talking about, you know, this being healthcare, which is a major, major issue, it comes back to the same basic, we must have Glass-Steagall in order to, you know, separate the investment banking.
Right. I couldn't agree more.
So that you know, we can come back to something like the Hill-Burton Act, which provided for for hospitals and hospital beds and caregivers for every person in our country that was, you know, hospitals were systematically built to provide a certain number of hospital beds per so much population. I'm sorry, I don't know the specifics of you know, what those numbers were, but I remember those times when, you know, it was ultimate importance that every person have access to excellent health care. And, you know, all those resources are still available to provide that excellent health care.
Yes, even despite the decline, we've had certain breakthroughs. I think Dr. Shelley was talking about eye surgery or different, you know, we have all, despite the growing dusk and dark towards dark ages, we could have fabulous care. And Judith, what you said too, I think that 1996 Act was only 9 pages long, and it specified that in rural areas where people have to maybe stay overnight, they can't go down the block to where they live in a city, you had maybe a ratio of 6 licensed beds per 1,000 people in their county. And in the city, it could be maybe 5 licensed bed or 4.5 licensed bed. Now we're into 2 licensed bed or fewer. And if you have a difficult delivery or an early delivery or a break your arm off your tractor in large parts of our country, you can't get to a hospital in time, and the mortality's going up.
Yeah, I can't. It's we live in a time of abundance. We have absolute abundance. And it's not that we don't have the resources. It's what did we do with those resources? Well, I mean, it's obvious that we didn't spend the resources on health care, or we wouldn't be 30th in the world in terms of, you know, indicators of quality of health care, and we wouldn't be spending two and a half times.
Yeah, you know, the infant mortality rate in our country is higher than, I mean, we're something like 15th in the world in infant mortality, the wealthiest country in the world, and we can't even keep our children, our infants alive.
Right.
And when it comes to some of the situation, for example, there's a shortage of radioactive material for nuclear medicine of different types. We have to import it all. And when the supply line breaks down, speaking of the most modern country in the world that the two of you just said, there are many ways we're at the end of the line, right?
Well, it's just, look at what technology has done as far as communication, transportation, and we keep building on what came before in terms of, and we had x-rays, which were able to help with the clinical diagnosis, and then we had CT scans, we had MRI scans, then we have PET scans. We have more and more and better diagnostics. The quality of our health care at the same cost should be, you know, climbing astronomically, exponentially. And instead, it's stagnant or falling as we spend more and more. But when you see a drug commercial on television, that's your healthcare dollar. It's not somebody else's. That's your healthcare dollar. When you see a billboard for a hospital, when you see a billboard for a malpractice lawyer, when you see the settlements of malpractice lawyers, when you see when your stock portfolio shows a 25 or 30% increase in pharmaceutical stock, that's your healthcare dollar. We shouldn't be spending that. There are only 3 countries in the world where it's legal to market drugs directly to the public.
Really?
And we're one of them. It's not ethical. It's not ethical. Socrates said, privilege flows from responsibility. The right to make to tell the patient that this is what they need, and then give the responsibility to the physician. The physician now has the responsibility that he, for a decision he didn't make.
And when you actually listen to the commercials for those medications, they're, which I'm sure are very expensive to give, the list, the laundry list of complications, possible complications that they actually list in the advertisement,
right,
would convince anyone not to take that medication.
Wow.
And all of the research and development that could go into, you know, actually having people become more healthy, rather than more than sicker and needing more medication, it's unfathomable that that's where our focus lies.
It's very hard to not be heartbroken and discouraged.
Well, let me ask you this. Dr. Shapiro, who was just saying off the air how he's been calling various networks non-medical, including veterans organizations, state legislators, who were reaching out to on the, this is the end of the line, the World War danger, or we're going to return to a real economy with Glass-Steagall. And the state legislatures are back in session, and we're mobilizing there just to turn the fire on Washington. But Arnie, Dr. Shapiro, you find some people more are responding, you might say, when the whole picture is there, especially on the issue that we have to set Obama aside, or what would you say?
Well, I haven't found too many, you know, too many people are willing to support impeaching Obama. They're cautious, you know. I talk to the trade union leaders, they're generally, they're cautious, and the Democratic Party, they're generally cautious about it, but you know, they're willing to hear it. I mean, they're certainly they don't react violently against it. I talked to a fellow who's a who's a highly placed person in the Veterans of Foreign Wars, and I spoke to him about, you know, the danger of nuclear war and why Obama has to be removed. He said, well, a lot of people would agree with you. He obviously doesn't dare say what he thinks, but I think the problem is more people are, unless they see a bandwagon, they're not going to come forward at this point. I think that's the problem. It's not that people don't hate Obama. I'm sure most people do hate him.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that that as things progress, that that nurses may be able to play more of a role in some of the in changing some of the ways that healthcare are delivered, because you know we're in the middle of an economy where they're trying to break the unions, and the nurses' unions are very strong. And I'm just hoping that our nurses will, you know, hold that strength, and you know come through, and also be able to hear more of the larger picture of, you know, of Glass-Steagall and what actually matters in revolutionizing our healthcare, that we as nurses might be able to, you know, play a key role there. I'm hopeful. I haven't seen a lot of it yet.
Well, I understand, Dr. Shelley, also you got, I mean, many people responded around the country, have signed your statement, and probably in about 15 states at least, or 20, I don't happen to know. But you got response in your own state, did you not?
Oh, yeah.
To someone stepping up and making the call, as Judith and you and the bandwagon effect of one person that Dr. Shapiro referred to. Can you describe that?
Well, I mean, other docs. I had docs call me, I had, you know, emails, I had a hospital administrator, retired hospital administrator, send me a letter, and they kept saying that it took courage. I'm thinking, I don't know that it would take courage to just simply state the truth. And but again, that opens up, opens another window on the problem, which I think Dr. Shapiro refers to, is there's a fear. There's fear. And people are afraid to say anything. I have to say, I don't think that is discouraged by the people in power today. I mean, that's the whole business of staying afraid it remains prevalent. But if we think about what are they afraid of? What's the fear? And it's the fear of being a job, a position, a situation. It comes back to principle not being as important as material.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, we as a society value our goods more than we value our name. We value, you know, the principle, the humanity, the past and the future are somehow able to be forgotten if our iPhones and our cars are threatened. And that's another, you know, as you try to get more and more foundational, that's a problem. That's we've come to believe that material goods are really important, are primary. It comes back to, are you paid so that you can see patients, or do you see patients so that you can be paid? And that's foundational. There needs to be a fairness and a balance. I think Dr. Shapiro is in a better position than any of us to give us. I mean, he's retired now, right, Dr. Shapiro?
Yeah, that's right.
And so you've seen a system that worked better than this one. I mean, what do you see as what can we do? What can we in the medical profession do to help turn this around? To re-principle medicine, to re-principle the students and residents who are in the nursing students.
I think it has to be addressed politically. We just, as part of the larger picture, we have to get rid of Obama. But the single biggest problem this country faces is having this person in the White House. He has to be gotten rid of. There's nothing, you can't get around it. There's nothing you can do to change the situation that you're reporting on, unless Obama's removed. That's all.
Yeah, I mean that certainly makes sense.
Right.
We have to somehow make people understand that they're whole, they're human. They're not going to be happy if they have more money. They won't be happy with the iPhone 6 or the iPhone 45. they will be happy when they've addressed their own humanity and the humanity of the people around them, and they've responded to that part of who they are. We've sold out. We've sold out to stuff. And truly, if you think about it, we do live in a time of incredible, incredible abundance. And we live in an abundance that comes from the American system, from McCormick's Reaper to Bell to Edison and on down. We have all our physical needs met, and then some. Apparently at the cost of our spiritual needs.
Right, and then the as a couple of you have referred to, you have the multi-billionaires, like apparently 85, only 85 in the entire world own more than two-thirds of the world's population at least. Hmm. So you have this potential you indicated, but then we're going backwards. We've done so for about 50 years. I began with the mention of the Kennedy Memorial, 50 years ago last Sunday. after he was dead, and he was memorialized in, after he was assassinated, he was memorialized in Boston in January 64. So in some ways that brings our discussion to a conclusion, but it shows we are certainly at a turning point here. And I appreciate all you on, and I want to say we like never before, we're going to be ordering Congress what to do when it comes to no more Obama, and state legislatures are in session. We're at many places at once in order to do this job. But I want to point out, besides thanking you, is we won't have a LaRouche show February 1st because we want everyone at 3 o'clock to tune in to a tremendous Science International webcast. Now that's on LaRouchePack.com, not where you're listening, LaRouchePub.com, but LaRouchePack.com at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, February 1st. It's called Fusion and Physical Chemistry, and it's part of the series on the continuing gifts of Prometheus, of where what we should be putting our efforts and our minds to, and people will very much enjoy that. And in the near future, we're going to have more on medicine and what we ought to have as a nuclear economic realm, and we don't right now. So I thank Judith Nergy in California, Mark Shelley, MD in Pennsylvania, and Ernest Shapiro, Dr. Shapiro in New York. And so this is the end of January 25, 2014, LaRouche Show, signing off. Thank you all very much.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for having us on.